You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Finally, producer Jack Marshall speaks to Dr. Simon Pollard about education, bugs and junk science.
So what's happening today?
Well, I'm writing a book. I wrote a book last year to go with the exhibition at Te Papa called The Genius of Bugs. And it was a finalist in the New Zealand Book Awards, which is nice. They have in the non-fiction section, they have the awards in a week or so. But then they asked me to write it's a sort of much bigger book, about 130 pages on New Zealand natural history for younger readers.
Oh, how exciting.
I know, it's great. It's great. And it's a lot of research on my part because I don't know about geology and plate tectonics and all that stuff that sort of form New Zealand, but it's good. And this is the first sentence of the first chapter, tell me what you think. A great place to start the story of wild and wonderful New Zealand is in the lush rainforests of Antarctica 50 million years ago.
Oh, yeah. That's good. That's good. I like it.
Yeah, it's apparently, I mean, this is a fun thing about researching books like that is you learn so much, but apparently just sort of in the last few years, managing to get DNA out of museum specimens of the elephant bird from Madagascar, it's the closest relative of the kiwi, and they think they shared an ancestor in the Antarctic.
Really?
Yeah. When they're all much more, countries much more crunched up, and that ancestor, they think also the ancestor of the kiwi flew here, that it lost the ability to fly later on, and everybody has this idea of sort of New Zealand drifting off and Moa's Ark type of thing, and you know, kiwis and moas are all closely related, and they're just not. But moas are more closely related to a pheasant-like thing in South America than they are to kiwis.
And then that's kind of, I think, the science we need for our kind of, you know, children and things growing up, is this kind of exciting science where it gets you thinking and you're wondering.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the other thing that's really important is that science changes. You know, our understanding of, say, chemistry and physics now compared to 200 years ago is enormous. When you look at, say, like that work with the elephant bird and the kiwi, it's only relatively recently that we've had the technology that allows you to go in there and say, well, no, these things are really closely related. Where before you'd go, well, they're geographically separated and, you know, the elephant bird was the size of a moa. But that's what I think is exciting for kids, is it's a process of discovery. And what I found last year was telling kids the stories that we told in Bug Lab, they just love multi-layered story. And I think they also love the violence of it all. You know, one of the most exciting stories I think we had last year was, it's a jewel wasp that lives in Africa. It uses cockroaches as a nursery for its offspring as well as a source of food. And, of course, the cockroach is not a willing partner in this. So the wasp grabs a cockroach and paralyzes it for about a minute and a half. Paralyzes the front legs for about a minute and a half. Because cockroaches can run at 8 meters a second when they really take off. And the wasp then does brain surgery on the cockroach. It goes in behind the back of the head and targets two parts of the brain and injects venom. And this causes the cockroach to lose the will to walk. It's totally capable of walking. It's not paralyzed. It just can't be bothered. And then... it also lowers the cockroach's metabolism. The venom lowers the cockroach's metabolism, and it's more likely to survive what it's about to go through. The venom also causes the cockroach to groom excessively for about half an hour to just get rid of any rubbish on its body. And while it's doing that, the wasp goes off to look for a nest, comes back, chews off one of the cockroach's antennae, and then tests the concentration of the venom by tasting the blood. And then it pulls the cockroach along like a dog on a leash to the nest and puts it in the nest, lays an egg on it, and then seals up the nest and leaves. And the egg hatches and the larva burrows into the body of the cockroach and eats it alive, but it eats all of the non-essential organs first to keep the cockroach alive as long as possible, because the larvae has to put on enough weight from eating the cockroach to be big enough to then pupate, and after a month it becomes an adult wasp. So it's this race against time. And the larvae also produces an antimicrobial that targets a bacteria that targets the cockroach. Again, it's sort of like, you know, fantastic amount of food there, but you don't want to be in a contaminated diner when you're eating. And gets about as big as the abdomen of the cockroach, the larva does, and then it pupates into a cocoon. And a month later, it comes out as an adult cockroach, burrows out of the nest, and if it's a female, goes off looking for a cockroach. And when I tell that story to kids, I mean, they love it. You know, they love the being eaten alive and all that stuff, and just the ingenuity of a wasp. This very, very specialised brain surgery. I mean, it's finer than anything you could do with humans. Its sting is about a 20th of a millimetre across, and it's going in and finding two specific parts of that cockroach brain. But kids also, when you say, well, wouldn't it be awful if you were, you know, paralysed, not paralysed, you lost the will to walk, and you're in a dark room, and you're being eaten alive? And they were going, oh, yeah. And I asked a teacher about that, and she said, unlike adults, we go, oh, my God, it's just unimaginable. Kids go, oh, okay, that's what it would be like. Yeah, but that would never happen to me. So it doesn't have the same sort of in-your-face effect that it does.
Yeah, and you can just imagine kids sitting there enthralled and their imagination's going wild, kind of in a classroom with a monstrous teacher.
Yes, exactly.
Going to paralyse them and make them learn.
Oh, I think so, yes. Or didn't Pink Floyd sing about that?
Yeah, and so you're big into science and educating and things like that.
I do. I think it's very important. It's part of the role of a scientist is to be able to communicate your science toward a broad audience. And of course, there's the language of science and the research and papers that come out of that research, that's for a specific audience, and that's going to use language and jargon that people that work in that field understand, but people outside that may not. But you can always explain it to anybody, whatever you're doing. It doesn't matter if it sounds like a really complicated complicated description or complicated research. I mean, I have very little knowledge of physics. If somebody, you know, last couple of years we had this idea that there were neutrinos, these subatomic particles that were travelling faster than the speed of light, and everybody in the science, now I don't know, I can't say, oh well, look, I did these equations and that shows that it's right or it's wrong, but I believe that the people that are checking that science are credible people, and the first thing they're going to go is, well no, that's impossible, you know, we're about to have 100 years of physics disappear into a black hole because this thing's going faster than the speed of light, which is meant to be the speed limit in the universe. And it turned out, and this is a very simplistic explanation, it turned out there was a faulty plug. So they were firing these subatomic particles from, I think, Italy to Switzerland, or Switzerland to Italy, and, you know, it was recording them as travelling faster than the speed of light. But, of course, they weren't. It was a faulty plug. And then everything adjusted, and they moved on from that. And I also assume they replaced the plug.
You'd hope so.
It did lead to a very good joke. We don't serve faster than the speed of light neutrinos in this bar. A neutrino walks into a bar. Yes, I think it's quite good.
Science jokes.
I know. They're really bad jokes. Really bad. I can't remember the Albert Einstein, but somebody said if you can't explain it to an 8-year-old, you don't understand it.
I think it was Richard Feynman.
Oh, fantastic, yes. Okay, Richard Feynman said that. Yeah, and I agree. And I mean, as I was saying to you earlier about writing this book on New Zealand natural history and learning about plate tectonics and about how New Zealand was formed, I can't write about it unless I understand it. And I will come up against a wall and I go, why does it do this? I thought it was meant to do this. And then I, you know, read more or ask somebody who's even more efficient, and they go, oh, it's because of this. And I go, okay, now it's clear in my head, and I can carry on writing and thinking about it.
Mm, I think one of my all-time favourite books, which my dad got me onto, was A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson.
Oh, lovely book.
And that's kind of that same idea. He starts the book talking about his science class, and it was just like the most boring class he'd ever been in. But then he opened his textbook and there was this diagram of the world that had just been like this big carving knife had just cut out like a fifth of the world, and you could see down through all the layers, and he was like, this is so amazing, why can't they talk like this? And so doing a book like yours, something, you know, like a short history of nearly everything in New Zealand, is kind of that's how we kind of get the next scientists excited.
Well, I think you do, and I mean, you know, we live in a wonderful country and we have this wonderful biodiversity, and we all know about things like kiwis and tuatara, and the moa used to live here, And yet there are all these other stories that aren't so well known that, again, are just as interesting, but they're often involving, you know, smaller animals. And the story of their lives, again, I find it just as interesting as knowing about what kiwi do or what moa do or what tuatara do. One of the interesting things in science is often the public have this idea of, you know, scientists going, eureka moment. You know, suddenly a light goes on in their head in the middle of the night and they go, that's what it is. And yet, when you look at most of the major science discoveries, it's more they go, that's funny, I wasn't expecting that. And, you know, the classic one with penicillin, with putting penicillin in in a growth medium and coming back the next day and they're all dead. And so the penicillin had acted to kill the bacteria, and I mean, that's sort of what led to that. And I there's a lovely cartoon. It's Watson and Crick, you know, discovered the structure of DNA with a female assistant, Frances, whose name I can't remember. They're in the bar. Down below it says, respondent being unable to interpret the latest results of the DNA research, Watson and Crick retire to the local bar. And the man next to them's lifting his hand up to the barman holding a glass and says, I'll have a double, Felix. Isn't that great?
Science jokes.
I know, that's the second one. I'll be taken off here. Never allowed to talk in public again. But the other thing that's interesting is on the flip side of science is, of course, you know, pseudoscience and junk science. And this is where people willingly and unwillingly use the language of science to make something sound scientific and credible. And, I mean, we're exposed to this, you know, every day, not necessarily with evil intent, but, you know, our detergent or our hand sanitizer kills 99.9% of all bacteria. Well, that's still a lot of bacteria that aren't being killed. And we think, you know, oh, that must be fine. And then you do get into sort of quackery, where people again use the language of science to sell a product that just does not make sense. It's just sort of scientifically impossible that it could be doing this. And one thing I came across recently was a product that was called harmonized water. And basically it was water that had various frequencies bombarded at it, various frequencies of sound or light, I'm not sure what it was. And somehow that made the water better than the water that comes out of the tap. And at $60 a bottle, you know, you're paying a lot for...
super water.
For yeah, exactly. And yet, you know, science just goes in and says, well, no, this is impossible. And if you don't have that background and you see a product that makes all these claims, you may not have the knowledge to go, well, no, you can't do that to water. So, I mean, my piece of advice there really is, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. You know, this has been going on. I mean, I've got a talk I'm giving this week. I've got all these old advertisements from going back, you know, 100 years, and it's like, now she wears the iodine locket. She is immune from, and it's just about every disease, and you see this little girl with a locket around her neck being immune. All the brain enhancing pills and salts and things you could take to help excessive thinking, brain mania, all these things that were inflicted with. But the other thing to remember is science doesn't necessarily get it right. And if we look back in the history of medicine, you know, I mean, can you imagine going to a GP in 2017 who says, I will only practice medicine as it was in 1917. I will not use anything beyond those years. And you would not go.
No.
you'd be very silly to go. Yeah, I'm sure there would be people that would go. But the point is that things change over time very quickly. And I remember, it was a documentary in the last few years on the history of cardiology, I think. And it showed a heart-lung machine that was only 50 years old. And yet it looked like a waterfall that you'd see in a department store window advertising something. It was this huge, primitive-looking apparatus.
Was that for polio or something like that?
No, this was actually a heart-lung machine. It was one of the first heart-lung machines. And you know, you remember the iron lungs that people had. And then you look at tragedies like thalidomide being used in the 1950s and leading to birth defects.
What was that?
Oh, thalidomide was a drug. I can't remember what it was used to treat, but it caused birth defects. So kids were born without arms or legs.
Mm.
And, of course, it was taken off the market, and they thought, oh, but you know, terrible mistake.
And it was like throughout the, early 1900s anyway, you get all these radiation creams with, you know...
Oh, I know.
Extra nucleus.
Yes, I know. Yeah, and, you know, it also allowed you to read books at night without turning on the light. It's probably quite useful. But, yeah, I think Richard Feynman, you mentioned earlier, he had a lovely saying. He said, science is a way of stopping us from fooling ourselves.
Mm.
You know, and I think that, like I said earlier, that self-regulation is very important. And I've presented the scenario that if we look at the idea of evolution of life on Earth, and we look at all this biodiversity and how old the Earth is and all of these things, if tomorrow somebody turned up and said, oh my God, I've just found a primate fossil that's 4 billion years old. It's older than anything else we've ever found on Earth. Everybody goes, oh, well, there's something not right here. And they go, well, no, we've done we've checked everything. And no, this was a primate that was here 4 billion years ago. Then if it was just, this is what's happened, then you start to rewrite the rules. It's just like, you know, imagine I don't know whether it's just whatever it's to do with our past, but we love things to do with Egyptology. It just seems to be in our psyche, you know, mummies and pyramids and sarcophaguses. And imagine, you know, new burial grounds are discovered in Egypt. I think there was one recently. Just imagine if they discovered an unopened burial chamber, nobody ever been in there, and they bring out this unopened sarcophagus and they x-ray it, and somebody goes, oh my God, there's a cell phone in it. It's an iPhone 10. It hasn't come out yet. And then it rings. Again, we'd be going, well, no, this is silly. Somebody's planted this and somebody's done this, somebody's done that. But if you started to eliminate all of the possibilities and the reality was there was a 4,000-year-old sarcophagus with a cell phone in it, then again, we would rethink the rules.
Well, they do say this pyramids were built by aliens because, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you look at the hieroglyphics.
No one can read them anyway.
Nobody can read them. I mean, I think one of the things of being human, and I sort of was trying to deal with this in this book, is we just can't comprehend geological time. You know, we can go back in our lifetimes, we can go back 100 years and go, well, that was life in 1917, and here's a picture of my grandfather as a young, you know, I'm 61, so my grandfather was born in 1899, so here's a picture of Tom when he was 15 in 1915 or 1916. But go back 1,000 years and it doesn't make sense. Go back 1,000,000 years. And you know, one of the things I saw, which is about the closest, it's not that you can comprehend it, but you can get your head around it a little bit, is if you took an American toilet roll that's 40 metres long, you divided those 400 sheets, each sheet was 12 million years, then five sheets from the end is the dinosaurs are going extinct. And that's 65 million years ago. There's this huge, long history on Earth. And if you take the last thousandth of a millimetre on the end of that toilet roll, that represents the last 100 years. You know, we're just, our existence is just such a tiny speck given the history. And I think the same thing happens with comprehending the size of the universe. Go back a couple of thousand years and people sort of thought the stars were really out there you could out there almost reach them. But you think of the, whatever left, was it left 1976 or 77, the one that's just sort of on the edge of the solar system, I think, one of the voyagers. Well, I think it's something like 75, I can't remember the exact numbers, it's either 75,000 or 120,000 years for that to get to the closest star.
Mm.
And, you know, it's like we all watch Star Trek and they just push the button and they're going 100 times the speed of light. Well, you know, even if we could travel at the speed of light, which is probably not going to happen, it still takes us, traveling at that speed, it takes 2 million years to get to the closest galaxy to us, to the Milky Way, to get to the Andromeda Galaxy. You know, they're just incomprehensible.
Yeah, I think there's some crazy numbers out there, like how wide the universe is. The chances are that there's almost like atoms structured the same way Earth is, or something like that. Just because the amount of chances there are for atoms to, you know, put themselves together, is that the absolute space and time just so large that you can't even. just beyond anything.
Absolutely. Look, I would put my money on it. There'll be life elsewhere. but we may never communicate with it. It may just be the distance is too great. It could be the tiniest change between, you know, life on another planet being able to communicate with us and 1,000 years ago, by if it had been 1,000 years earlier. Imagine if, you know, 2,000 years ago they were sending out signals from wherever and people just didn't have the technology to read those signals. I'm sure that life does seem to be something that happens in the universe. And it's funny, I remember reading somewhere where that said, you know, the human brain is probably the most amazing thing that's ever evolved in the universe. But guess who told us that?
Who?
Our brain.
Exactly.
You know, and I don't know, it might have an agenda there.
Slightly biased, I've found.
Yeah, you can't trust brains, really. Quite untrustworthy.
So just to finish off,
yes.
we've got science, but how do we make sure that people actually know the difference between junk science and not junk science?
Well, the trouble is, if you go online, there are reputable websites, but there's a hell of a lot that aren't. And I think it's also using common sense. You know, a lot of quackery and a lot of sort of superstitious beliefs don't change. That they'll be rooted in the physics and chemistry of 200 years ago, and now we go, well, no, that's impossible. You know, that just cannot happen. And what we also need to remember is we're very susceptible to the placebo effect. You know, if I said to you, I've got a technique where I can take, you know, the eyes are the window to the soul and the soul controls the body. So if I show your eyes a picture of a disease, then it will travel to the soul and the soul will send that picture off and cure you. And, you know, I could go with, say, a cold, or I might have a condition. I've always got, you know, dry skin or something terrible, and this person uses this technique and they go, oh my God, I'm cured. It must be true, more than the power suggestion. So I think it is looking at it carefully and going, no, this sounds too good to be true. And if somebody is going to charge you $60 for a bottle of harmonized water, just be suspicious.
It's true. if you have $60 for a bottle of water, maybe that's all right. Maybe you've got too much money.
I would have water that had a lot of alcohol in it for $60 and probably had quite a nice flavour as well.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.